Thank you for that very generous introduction. Now I just ask, is Charlie Emmerich here? I didn't recognize him in the introduction. Very generous. Thank you. I have some good news and bad news. The good news is this is not the text of my talk. Bad news is I got together with the other speakers and we put together an examination for all of you, which you'll be given at the end of the day. Okay. It's truly a delight to be here. My wife Susan and I met at an InterVarsity conference here in Chicago 6 years ago. So this brings back many fond memories. I was that admiring bachelor in the audience when she was speaking, and I do have to confess, I was looking to see if she had a ring on her finger, and you know the one I mean. And so God was very gracious to me, and we had a wonderful conference, and it wasn't just a conference about the mind either. Now, I need to make two caveats. First is I'm time challenged, okay? It's like the kid who looked at his mom in church and said, "Mom, what does it mean when the pastor puts his watch on the pulpit?" She said, "Honey, it means absolutely nothing at all." Okay, so I'm time challenged. We'll go right in with that, disability studies. Second is I'm intellectually scarred because I've done 2 law degrees and compiled over 100 some hours of legal education. And as you know, in the law, they use the Socratic method. And I literally did have nightmares in law school, in particular about one particular law professor. A peculiar little man with slick black hair, huge, Mr. Seinfeld type glasses, named Norman Vieira. And one day in particular, I hadn't been able to do the homework. By the way, his nickname was Barracuda. And 3 of us would sit in the back row and we would make bets about who the Barracuda was going to call on that day. And we would do this at the beginning of class. Dun, 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 dun. And Norman was one of these guys that just had a knack of knowing who was coming into the class unprepared. Of course, I was unprepared this day. We were covering the obscenity cases. And I got 2 of the cases confused, Ohio versus Jacob Ellis. Probably the only 2 cases I remember because they're seared in my memory. That was the case where Justice Potter Stewart said, "I can't define obscenity, but I know it when I see it." Okay, that's very helpful intellectually. And then the next case was Miller versus California. Now, I did the best I could when Norman called on me, Stormin' Norman. And the problem was I had confused the facts of the 2 cases. And after he had asked a couple questions, he said, "Mr. Emmerich, it's clear that you are befuddled beyond hope. Why don't I just talk to one of your classmates about another case, and we'll get back to you in about 15 minutes with Miller versus California." And so I was scrambling right there to brief that case and made it through legal education. And now, the task at hand. I'm supposed to talk about law and politics and the Christian in the law and in the public arena, and I'm supposed to do that in about 40 minutes, and that's no small order for a former theology student turned law professor type. In this regard, I'll never forget at Wheaton College when I announced to my former classmates who are theology students that I was going to go to law school. This was during the Star Wars era, and they said, Luke, don't turn to the dark side. Come back. But I've never regretted going into the law. I think it's a grand and noble calling. Maybe some of you have had the opportunity to watch the Senate confirmation hearings of John Roberts. Clearly, you can't watch those hearings for long without knowing how passionate he is about the law and how much he reveres the law for all of its faults. I share his sentiments and believe that one of the chief tasks of Christendom is to restore the honorable nature of public service and law government and politics. Now, to bring some focus to my topic, I will begin by examining the life and legacy of John Witherspoon, one of America's greatest theologian statesmen. He provides an inspirational model of Christian citizenship within the Reformed tradition. In addition, he taught and embodied several foundational truths for formulating a vibrant, biblically-based conception of politics and law. After exploring Witherspoon's legacy, I will briefly discuss the Anglo-American higher law tradition and the way in which it informed the legal foundations of the Republic. Finally, I will comment on the ascendancy and devastating effects of legal positivism and on my calling to play a modest role in turning back this tide. Now, first, the life and legacy of John Witherspoon. Few American founders exemplified the concept of public service founded on Christian principles better than Witherspoon. Ordained in the Church of Scotland, he emigrated to America in 1768 to accept a position as president of the fledgling Presbyterian College of New Jersey, today known as Princeton University. He quickly threw his considerable talents behind the Patriot cause and was the only minister to sign the Declaration of Independence. Many of his students at the college became prominent leaders in the Republic. In addition to one president, James Madison, they included 6 representatives to the Continental Congress, 21 United States senators, 39 members of Congress, and 3 Supreme Court justices. In addition to his duties as a minister and educator, Witherspoon served as a member of the Continental Congress, as a state legislator, and as a delegate to the New Jersey Convention that ratified the United States Constitution. Toward the end of his life, Witherspoon summarized his conception of Christian citizenship, declaring, "In a public view, every good citizen is called to live and act for the glory of God and the good of others. Nor am I able to conceive any character more truly great than that of one, whatever be his station or profession, who is devoted to the public good under the immediate order of providence." This quotation points to at least 3 theological convictions essential for formulating a Christian view of public engagement. First, the sovereignty of God. Second, the noble and honorable nature of public service. And third, an affirmation of transcendent moral truth. At the heart of Witherspoon's concept of public service was an abiding belief in the sovereignty and providence of God. As he put it, every action is under the immediate order of providence. A proper Christian understanding of politics and law must rest on the theological truth that Christ, the eternal Word or Logos, holds together and exercises lordship over all things, including all of history and human destiny, all of the created order, all human authorities and institutions, and all knowledge, mystery, and wisdom. This means, as Professor Arthur Holmes, who by the way, I studied under at Wheaton College, some of you have probably heard of Art Holmes, a tremendous scholar. Art Holmes states in summarizing Abraham Kuyper's thinking on Calvinism, that thinking affirms that the entire universe and all of life belong to Christ, and that it is from this central Christian conviction that thought and action must begin. The lyrics of John Ryland capture this emphasis on the sovereignty of God. "Sovereign ruler of the skies, ever gracious, ever wise, all my times in thy hand, all of events at thy command. His decree who formed the earth fixed my first and second birth. Parents, native place and time, all appointed were by him. He that formed me in the womb, he shall guide me to the tomb. All my time shall ever be ordered by his wise decree. Times of sickness, times of health, times of poverty and wealth. Times of trial and grief, times of triumph and relief. Plagues and deaths around me fly, till he bids, I cannot die. Not a single shaft shall hit till the love of God sees fit." The truth that a loving, sovereign God holds everything in his hands through the dominion and lordship of Christ means that we can have boundless hope. It also has enormous consequences for Christians in the academy, for it suggests that every Christian professor and student, no matter what their institutions, disciplines, or majors, should be theologians with a small t. That is, they should each strive continually to understand what it means to submit every aspect of their academic and vocational callings to the Lordship of Christ. In the realm of politics and law, a belief in a theistic God who exercises absolute sovereignty over his created order gave rise to the venerable principle in the Anglo-American tradition of the rule of law under God. As Winston Churchill declared, "There is a law which is above the king and which even he must not break." Now, perhaps some of you are wondering, what does it mean to be a theologian with a small t in law and politics? Well, for one thing, it means doing tedious, hard work studying scripture and subsequent Christian and non-Christian teachings concerning, for example, the origins, responsibilities, and limitations of government and the relationship between Christian faith and civic duty. An erudite 2,000-year history of Christian political and legal thought can be traced through thinkers such as the Apostle Paul, Augustine, Aquinas, Bracton, Luther, Calvin, Cook, Grotius, Pufendorf, Blackstone, Rutherford, Burke, Witherspoon, Acton, and many others. It is our responsibility, at least at a rudimentary level, to begin to appropriate this vast storehouse of wisdom. In my own career, for example, I had the good fortune to study the development of the Anglo-American tradition of religious freedom under Judge Arlen Adams, distinguished jurist who taught at the University of Pennsylvania. My studies and our subsequent collaborations opened up a whole new world of ideas for me. The story of the development of religious liberty enshrined in the First Amendment is one which implicates many of the grand themes of human history. The duties owed to the Creator and to Caesar, the relationship between religion and government, the concept of the state and the authority of civil government, the source and scope of inalienable rights, civic virtue and the limits of human freedom, the quest for the common good in a free society, and the roles of liberty of conscience and civil disobedience all find their place in this story. Now, turning to Witherspoon's concept of public service as a noble and honorable means of serving God. In addition to stressing the sovereignty of God, Witherspoon praised public service in politics, law, and government as noble and as honorable, and as a means of showing one's love for God and for neighbor. In this, he followed the Protestant reformers, particularly John Calvin, who once declared, "No doubt ought now to be entertained by any person that politics is a calling not only holy and legitimate, but by far the most sacred and honorable in human life." Witherspoon taught that good citizenship was the responsibility of every Christian, and that Christian citizenship consisted of civic virtue characterized by self-sacrifice for the glory of God and the good of others. In other words, all of us, everyone here, no matter what our vocational callings or academic spheres or other responsibilities in life, are expected to be politically educated and informed, to vote, to pray for our leaders, to voice our opinions, to engage in public debate, and to serve in some capacity that inures to the common good. According to Witherspoon, the continued vitality of the Republic depended on a virtuous citizenry concerned about the common good and true religion, yet committed to liberty of conscience in religious matters. "A constitution is excellent," he declared in his lectures on moral philosophy, "when the spirit of the civil laws is such as to have a tendency to prevent offenses and make good men, as much as to punish them when they do evil." Contrast that with the Holmesian view of law for the bad man. Such an exalted view of government and public service provides much needed encouragement to Christians in politics and law, for it recognizes the inherent value of their callings. As Witherspoon emphasized, a Christian who faithfully fulfills his or her responsibilities as a citizen is glorifying God, as well as serving others. In line with this recognition, I view my principal task at Trinity Christian College to be that of inspiring students to formulate and implement a Christian worldview, and I say that unapologetically, encompassing active civic engagement to the glory of God. Because the college years are so formative, it is imperative that Christian institutions and educators perform this task well, coming alongside the family and the church to train our young people as virtuous citizens fit for service to church and society. Now, finally, an affirmation of transcendent moral truth in Witherspoon's thought. The biblical truth that there exists a higher divine law standing over and sometimes against governmental authority was accepted by Witherspoon and virtually every other American founder. It is the bedrock principle upon which our colonial ancestors established the American constitutional order, and it is the basis for the deep respect which the founders had for liberty of conscience and religious matters. For most of its thousand-year history, the Anglo-American legal tradition affirmed the principle of transcendence, the idea that the Lord, a God of justice, has created a well-ordered universe governed by immutable moral principles, that these principles form the basis for an objective and knowable, at least in part, concept of justice, and that this concept of justice, the natural or higher law, served as a standard by which to assess human governments, institutions, and laws. Unfortunately, this noble tradition has deteriorated under the onslaught of legal positivism and other naturalistic ideologies, prompting eminent Harvard legal scholar Harold Berman to write in 1983 that, quote, "The Western legal tradition is in a revolutionary crisis greater than any other in its history, one that some believe has brought it virtually to an end," unquote. Before turning to a brief consideration of this higher law tradition, it is appropriate to observe that a view of politics and law premised on the lordship of Christ and an affirmation of transcendence provides light and hope in the midst of a culture in crisis. Such a view affirms the existence of a sovereign, personal and caring God whose creation in its pristine estate was pronounced good. Consequently, as Witherspoon and other founders taught, the created order is governed by transcendent moral truth emanating from God's divine character. Because there is a comprehensive order to existence, it is possible, even in a fallen world, to strive for an understanding of this orderliness. The Christian scholar or student can, in short, begin to formulate a unified and comprehensive worldview corresponding with reality, flawed though it may be, in a fallen world. Such an outlook brings confidence and meaning to teaching and scholarship, for it affirms, as Arthur Holmes stated, that all truth is God's truth, or all truth is God's truth, and that every discovery, contribution, and idea leading to truth has value. Now, the one question I had about Art Holmes was, how can you live in this country for 35 or 40 years and still have a thoroughgoing British accent? But I don't have the answer to that, but I think it's because if you're British, you can read the phone book and it sounds intellectual. Now, turning to the Anglo-American higher law tradition. During his confirmation hearings in 1991, Clarence Thomas raised the ire of Lawrence Tribe and other law professors when he referred favorably to the natural law principles underlying the Declaration of Independence. Expressing alarm and dismay, Tribe and others decried Thomas's jurisprudence as, quote, troubling and as, quote, a threat to democratic government, unquote. My friend Michael McConnell, then a professor at the University of Chicago and now a federal appellate judge, came to Thomas's defense in an op-ed piece published in the New York Times in August 1991. McConnell made the seemingly obvious point that understanding the Constitution in light of the natural law principles held by the American founders can hardly be called weird or dangerous. What is troubling, in my view, is not Thomas's allegiance to the venerable concept of natural law, but the arrogance of his critics who ignored centuries of legal tradition and yet presumed to speak for the American legal community. Even a cursory examination of the higher law tradition reveals that it provided the philosophical underpinnings for American law from the settlement of Virginia in 1607 until relatively modern times. As is well documented in Edwin Corwin's classic work, The Higher Law Background of American Constitutional Law, this outlook can be traced seamlessly from the earliest colonial settlements to modern times, from the Mayflower Compact in 1620 to William Penn's Frame of Government of Pennsylvania in 1682 to Witherspoon's Lectures on Moral Philosophy, which began at Princeton in 1768, to the Declaration of Independence in 1776, to Joseph Story's opinion for the United States Supreme Court in U.S. versus Amistad in 1841, to Lincoln's famous Thanksgiving Proclamation during the Civil War, to the Reverend Martin Luther King Jr.'s letter from a Birmingham jail in 1963, to name just a few sources. In an introduction to Corwin's book, Professor Clinton Rossiter correctly observed that American citizens have revered the Constitution primarily because of the deep-seated conviction that it is an expression of the higher law, that it is, in fact, imperfect man's most perfect rendering of what Blackstone saluted as the eternal, immutable laws of good and evil, to which the Creator himself and all his dispensations conforms. Renowned political theorist Alexander de Entrevez captured the breathtaking historical sweep of natural law theory when he wrote, "But for natural law, the petty laws of a small peasant community of peninsular Italy would never have become the universal law of an international civilization. But for natural law, the great medieval synthesis of godly and of worldly wisdom would not have been possible. But for natural law, there probably would have been no American or French revolutions, nor would the great ideals of freedom and equality have found their way into the law books after having found it into the hearts of men." As de Entrevez emphasized, natural law has played a prominent role in human thought and history for thousands of years. It has a distinguished and multifaceted past and stands as a constant reminder that law is inextricably linked to moral inquiry and must ultimately be grounded in a transcendent concept of justice. Most germane to our topic, a particular strand of natural law theory developed by the common law courts provided the roots for the Anglo-American legal tradition and for the jurisprudence prevailing at the time of our nation's founding. Henry de Bracton, an English judge and one of the fathers of the common law, wrote in the 13th century, for example, that, quote, "God is the author of justice, for justice is in the Creator, and accordingly right and law have the same source and meaning," unquote. 3.5 centuries later, Chief Justice Edward Coke concluded in Calvin's case, decided in 1610, that the nature of law is immutable, that it is part of the law of England, and that it stands in precedent before any judicial or municipal law. He declared, quote, "The law of nature is that which God at the time of creation of the nature of man infused into his heart for his preservation and direction. And this is the lex aeterna, the moral law, called also the law of nature." In his celebrated Commentaries on the Constitution, published in the 1750s, Sir William Blackstone continued the line of thinking evident in Bracton and Coke. Blackstone posited that there was a universal natural law that stemmed from the character of God and divine law. This natural law was discoverable through reason, experience, and most importantly, revelation. The enactments of government, Blackstone wrote, derived their legitimacy directly from this natural law. "No human laws are of any validity," he said, "if contrary to this natural law, and such of them as are valid derive all their force and all their authority from this original." According to Blackstone and the other English jurists, Christianity formed a part of the common law in the sense that it provided the moral aspirations for legal precedent. Consequently, judges working within the common law tradition viewed their chief task as rendering decisions within lines of precedent which better and better approximated the ideal standard of justice taught by Christian truth. The American founders inherited and embraced the English common law tradition and agreed that Christianity formed a part of the common law and should be looked to as the source for the higher law or moral seedbed informing judicial decision making. Virtually all of the founders, whether evangelical, deistic, broadly theistic, or even anti-clerical, agreed that there was a sovereign God who had created a well-ordered universe governed by these higher principles. They emphasized that these moral principles formed the basis for an objective and noble concept of justice, and that human law should strive to conform to and is accountable to justice. A citizen who obeyed a human ordinance that conflicted with God's law, they regarded as foolish. Herein lies the deep respect for conscientious objection in our legal tradition. Now, the founders stressed both duties and rights. On the one hand, there were duties to honor the Creator and to nurture a virtuous citizenry committed to the common good. On the other hand, the founders taught that certain rights were inalienable. That is, that they had been granted by God and therefore were superior to all human obligations. Thus, on the eve of the Revolution, John Dickinson declared that the colonists' rights derived not from kings and parliament, but from a source that is higher, the King of Kings and the Lord of all the earth. James Madison expressed a similar sentiment. In an eloquent defense of liberty of conscience, Madison wrote in 1785, "It is the duty of every man to render to the Creator such homage and such only as he believes to be acceptable to him. This duty is precedent both in order of time and in degree of obligation to the claims of civil society." According to the founders, the Creator had not only established a moral ordering to the universe, he also stood in judgment over both individuals and nations. George Washington consistently and eloquently voiced this truth throughout a long and distinguished career. Thus, in his proclamation for the first National Thanksgiving, Washington declared that it was the duty of all nations to acknowledge the providence of Almighty God, to obey his will, to be grateful for his benefits, and humbly implore his protection and favor. In sharp contrast to Holmes's perspective, the founders designed the Constitution to guide an educated and virtuous citizenry, not to serve as the basis for a legal order premised upon fear and coercion. As John Adams stated in 1798, our Constitution was made only for a moral and religious people. It is wholly inadequate to the government of any other. The founders set forth the fundamental political theory underlying the new republic in the nation's first piece of organic law, the Declaration of Independence, generally regarded as the most cherished document in American history. And as an aside, I should note that the National Archives runs surveys fairly consistently on what is the most cherished document in American political history, and the Declaration always finishes first, outdistancing even our Constitution. Generally regarded as the most cherished of these documents, the Declaration was intended, in the words of its principal author, Jefferson, to be an expression of the American mind. He recommended it, along with Washington's farewell address, to be the two best guides for understanding the distinctive principles of American government. Juridically, the Declaration created a new nation. It is a part of our fundamental organic law. If you go to the law library, and John can confirm this, and go to the statutes at large, and turn to volume one, and turn to the very first piece of legislation, you will find there the Declaration of Independence. But since that time, its eloquent theory and language have inspired abolitionists in their struggle against slavery, those who championed women's suffrage, and the leaders of the civil rights movement. Although the document's 56 signers represented six denominations, encompassing a spectrum of views from Jefferson's Enlightenment deism to Witherspoon's Christian orthodoxy, they agreed on the self-evident propositions of the higher law tradition outlined above. The Declaration is neither silent nor neutral when it comes to the great questions of political theory. It contains four references to God and boldly proclaims, "We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, that they are endowed by their Creator with certain unalienable rights, that among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness." Now, turning to the modern crisis in law, there is hope. We're two-thirds of the way through here. So hang in there. It's been a long conference, but I want to turn to talking about law and the modern crisis we face. Two centuries later, we are witnessing the systematic dismantling of the founders' vision for our constitutional democracy. Over the last three generations, American law has incrementally abandoned theistic natural law, turning instead to naturalistic and utilitarian philosophies premised upon the tenet that transcendent moral truths and hence justice do not exist. As a result, law has become merely procedural and formal, a means for channeling social and political power without any moral accountability. The Conan the Barbarian view of law, might makes right, has replaced transcendence. Maybe some of you have seen that movie, Arnold Schwarzenegger, now our governor of California. He's sitting around the campfire with his friends. One of his friends says, "Conan, what is good in life?" Conan responds, "To crush your enemies, to see them flee before you, and to hear the lamentations of their women." That is the might makes right view of the law. That is also the view of Holmes, as Professor Altshuler made clear yesterday. Now, how did this state of affairs come about? The decline of the higher law thinking in American jurisprudence can be traced to the mid-19th century. Indeed, most scholars agree that the last significant use of natural law theory by the United States Supreme Court occurred in 1841 in United States versus the Amistad, the case which Steven Spielberg celebrated in his movie by the same name. In that case, the court considered a complicated set of facts involving Africans who had been kidnapped and enslaved and were being transported on the Spanish schooner La Amistad. During a voyage to a Cuban harbor, the Africans mutinied, killed the ship's captain, and seized the schooner. However, they lost their way at sea and eventually drifted to offshore Connecticut, where they were directed into harbor by a United States naval vessel. The basic issue in the case was the status of the Africans. Were they slaves or were they free? Former President John Quincy Adams, a devout Christian and staunch defender of natural law, represented the Africans. Speaking through Justice Joseph Story, himself a brilliant advocate of natural law, the court concluded that the Africans were free and that their dreadful acts to regain their freedom did not thereby make them robbers, or pirates under the law of nations. In reaching this decision, Story wrote, quote, "The conflict of rights between the parties under such circumstances becomes positive and inevitable and must be decided upon the eternal principles of justice and international law." The spirit of the Amistad case is captured in the famous declaration by Adams that this principle, that a whole nation has a right to do whatever it pleases, cannot in any sense whatever be admitted to be true. The eternal and immutable laws of justice and morality are paramount to all human legislation. The violations of those laws is certainly within the power of a nation, but it is not among the rights of a nation. Since the Amistad case, the rapid secularization of law can be laid largely at the doorstep of legal education. In the two generations after the nation's founding, law was included among the liberal arts and other disciplines in American colleges and universities. As a result, students studied law in a broader context of exploring knowledge in fields such as theology, philosophy, ethics, history, political theory, and rhetoric. This pedagogical approach placed the study of law within a broader framework of moral analysis and accountability. In the latter half of the 19th century, a movement developed under the leadership of Christopher Langdell at Harvard and others to make law a science deserving of its own separate schools. Significantly, as law professor Philip Johnson stresses, this movement occurred at the same time as the ascent of social Darwinism, which provided a philosophical foundation for legal positivism and the notion that there is no necessary connection between law and morality, or between what is and what ought to be. One of the disciples of social Darwinism, as Professor Altshuler so vividly described yesterday, was Justice Oliver Wendell Holmes. Gifted with a forceful personality and a keen intellect, Holmes left an indelible, albeit unfortunate, mark on American jurisprudence. He did this by attacking the last remnants of natural law and substituting thoroughly naturalistic, even nihilistic, approaches. A barometer evidencing Holmes's success in this regard is the fact that the vast majority of law professors today disdain Blackstone as a quaint dunderhead and revere Holmes as a brilliant legal titan. Now, as an aside, I would like to ask, think about what would have happened if, when Holmes was in college at Harvard, a Christian professor had mentored Oliver Wendell Holmes. Think about the possibilities. Think in his initial interest in terms of joining a Christian club at Harvard, and a mentor had come along and kept him within the higher law tradition. What a difference it would make in the landscape that we see today in the law. A little exercise in hypothetical thinking there. Now, the lay public has astutely and correctly detected that there is a crisis in modern American law. They realize that there is something fundamentally wrong with our legal system and with many of those who are administering it. What the public would be alarmed to learn is that the reason for this crisis is that many lawyers, judges, law professors, and lawmakers do not care about what is fair, right, and just, because they have been trained to believe that such aspirations are not the purview of the law, and that justice, if it exists at all, is an irrational concept outside the domain of the science of law. It is not hard to envision where this type of legal education will lead us. In reflecting on the way in which legal positivism facilitated the rise of Nazism, German theologian Helmut Thielicke said, "As soon as the world loses the father of the world, as soon as it is deprived of God, it must necessarily be stripped of the invisible. And among invisibles, naturally, are norms such as justice and also the ethical laws of value that determine good and evil." Lest we think Thielicke's assessment is an overstatement, one should consider a passage from a jurisprudence text written by Judge Richard Posner, himself a follower of Holmes, who espouses a reductionistic jurisprudence premised upon economic analysis. Posner writes, "The majority of educated Americans believe that nature is the amoral scene of Darwinian struggle. Occasional attempts are made to derive social norms from nature, so conceived, but they are not likely to succeed. It is true that a variety of widely accepted norms, including the keeping of certain promises, the abhorrence of unjustified killing of human beings, and perhaps even the sanctity of property rights, promote the adaptation of the human species to its environment. But so does genocide." So where do we, as a culture, find ourselves today in assessing the law? One need not be politically astute or even well-informed to realize that, unless checked, the popular fear in law schools today will spell the end of our civilization as we know it. Of the nation's 191 ABA law schools, there are probably not more than 10 or 12 which teach natural law or the views of the founders in a serious way. Indeed, originalism, the view that the Constitution should be interpreted in the light of the original intent of the framers, is almost uniformly rejected and ridiculed in the legal academy today. Similarly, it has become fashionable in law school to mock Blackstone and other natural law theorists, as well as the Judeo-Christian values which they held. I do not regard myself as an alarmist, but I must confess that I am alarmed. Indeed, apart from my faith in Christ, I would have little or no hope. We are not yet facing the stark brutality confronted under totalitarian regimes, but ominous and overtly evil trends currently threaten the nation and our churches as never before. Prominent voices such as the Catholic bishops, J.I. Packer, Carl F. H. Henry, Philip Johnson, John Stott, and Charles Colson have repeatedly testified to this urgent state of affairs, warning that a naturalistic legal ideologies continue to gain ground, they will lead to barbarism. Unfortunately, in my view, America's religious community, while doing some, has not done enough to heed these voices. Instead, it has generally responded in one of three ways: by denying cultural realities, well, it's really not as bad as you think; by diluting doctrine to accommodate socially acceptable norms; or by retreating and creating separate subcultures. For example, I ask, how is it that American Christendom permitted the law to undermine the most basic tenet of our nation, announced in the Declaration of Independence? The idea that each human life is precious and has inherent worth because God creates each human in his own image. After reading Dr. Nigel Cameron's work, The New Medicine, Life and Death After Hippocrates, I can only conclude that many Christians in higher education and in the professions are either too timid to face reality or too out of touch to know what is really happening. Written by an eminent medical ethicist, this disturbing book documents a chilling paradigm shift in medicine and law. It traces the decline of the Hippocratic Oath and its commitment to the intrinsic sanctity of human life and the physician as a healer. According to Cameron, the traditional view has given way to a new pagan medicine, premise on the concept of the life not worth living, and the doctor as an agent of social eugenics, the doctor as a killer. The most characteristic feature of this contemporary post-Hippocratic medicine, Cameron writes, is the progressive marginalization of those who are the weakest and the most powerless in the clinical situation. The numbers of those marginalized in American society has steadily grown over the last 3+ decades. Today, as Cameron documents in his book, aborted fetuses, some of whom have reached 24 to 26 weeks of gestation, have in fact been kept alive for use as laboratory guinea pigs in experimentation. In the meantime, medical ethicists have reached the point where they now routinely debate the worth, indeed even the human status, of severely deformed newborns, the seriously handicapped, the terminally ill, and the elderly. Perhaps most alarming is the candor with which the new pagan doctors speak. In Should the Baby Live, the problem of handicapped infants, Helga Kulsa and Peter Singer echoed the views of Holmes when they stated, "We think that some infants with severe disabilities should be killed." Operating from the evolutionary premise that the human being is just another animal, they contend that some non-human animals should be entitled to greater protection than some human animals. Thus, they declare, pigs, cows, and chickens have a greater capacity to relate to others, better ability to communicate, and far more curiosity than the most severely retarded humans. To those who would dismiss Dr. Cameron's book as alarmist, it deserves emphasis that the Kusa-Singer work was published by Oxford University Press, and that, in fact, Singer, if I remember correctly, is teaching as a bioethicist today at Princeton. Think about that in John Witherspoon. As Christian citizens, scholars, and educators, we simply cannot continue to live as if the crisis in law does not exist. The stakes are too high. We must face the fact, whether we like it or not, that the law stands at the center of this nation's future to a great extent, and that our future together as a community of faith and as a society is hitched to this wagon called law. The facts bear out this assessment, as well as the observation by one sociologist that the most powerful tribal group in the world is the American lawyer. The tribe now consists of over 1 million members. It speaks the same language, legalese, has its own dress code, practices its own unique rituals and ceremonies, largely regulates the behavior of the other tribes or groups in the society, and adheres to its own religious faith, established largely on moral relativism, indeed even nihilism, and on a materialism premised upon success, wealth, and prestige. The members of this tribe occupy the most strategic and powerful positions in American culture. They possess all the federal judgeships and sit in almost all the key positions in the state judiciaries. They greatly outnumber the representatives of other professions and callings in the state and federal legislatures, and they occupy the lion's share of high-level executive positions in the federal as well as state governments. In the non-governmental sector, the American lawyer serves in leadership roles in business, charities, religious institutions, healthcare, and numerous other institutions. For example, according to one study, 65% of the CEOs of America's Fortune 500 companies are lawyers. Those who distinguish themselves in the legal tribe become judges and law professors. These two highly strategic groups, in turn, exercise tremendous authority in our society. Federal judges sit for life and therefore are not accountable to the electorate. They have become an imperial judiciary, or to borrow Learned Hand's famous description, an assembly of Platonic guardians. By virtue of the doctrine of judicial review, judges are ultimate interpreters of the Constitution and therefore can effectively veto the considered actions of the other two branches of government. From a long-term perspective, the law professors may exert an even greater influence on the society than the federal judges. This elite fraternity consists of about 5,000 members at the 191 ABA law schools nationwide. A sobering statistic is that well over 90% of these professors hold a law degree from about one of a dozen schools. In other words, a dozen elite schools educate about 95% of us who go into the law and into the public arena and into leadership positions in our society. Even more sobering is the fact that almost to the last one, these prestigious schools explicitly reject or fail to teach jurisprudential views premised on the transcendent. Given these developments, it should not be surprising that the public disdains the law and the legal profession. Is it any wonder that American citizens hold lawyers in such low esteem, or that so many in the law are disillusioned, despairing, or hurting? As Harvard Law professor Marianne Glendon declared, American lawyers wealthier and more powerful than their counterparts anywhere else in the world are in the grip of a great sadness. According to law professor Joseph Allegretti, the root cause of this sadness is a spiritual crisis. Lawyers in the profession have lost their way. Shortly before he died of cancer, Yale law professor Arthur Leff uttered an existential plea for help in his last Law Review article. He said this, "I want to believe, and so do you, in a complete, transcendent, and immanent set of propositions about right and wrong, findable rules that authoritatively and unambiguously direct us how to live righteously. But all I can say is this, it looks as if we are all that we have. Given what we know about ourselves and each other, this is an extraordinarily unappetizing prospect. Looking around the world, it appears that if all men are brothers, the ruling model is Cain and Abel. Neither reason nor love nor even terror seems to have worked to make us good. As things now stand, everything is up for grabs. God help us." At this point, I'm sure some of you are saying, what a bleak picture. What can we do as Christian scholars and citizens to turn the situation around? First of all, I agree, it is a bleak picture. I believe that's reality. I believe an honest assessment and appraisal leads to that conclusion. I also agree with Leff's plea or prayer. God help us. That's the source of our help. As Dallas Willard so forcefully reminded us yesterday, God will help us despite our weaknesses. He will help us and work through us as we learn how to love Him with our whole beings, and in particular for those of us in the academy, with our minds. As Professor Willard wrote in his masterful work, The Divine Conspiracy, We must develop a straightforward presentation in word and life of the reality of life now under God's rule through reliance upon the word and person of Jesus. In this way, we can naturally become his students or apprentices. We can learn from him how to live our lives. We can enter his eternal kind of life now. By way of closing, I would like to share about one of the ways in which I've taken up this call. What does it mean to be Christ's disciple in the law? In 1996, after teaching for 5 years at Wheaton College, I accepted the invitation of the Christian Legal Society to serve as its first director of law student ministries. This position, which I occupied for 6 years, afforded me a unique and strategic opportunity to help reach the next generation of lawyers for Jesus Christ. As a traveling law professor for CLS, I had the opportunity to speak at over 50 law school campuses throughout the country and to meet with and encourage hundreds of law students in their Christian faith and to get a heartbeat for what's happening out in the field. When I left the Christian Legal Society in 2001 to return to an academic career, I was encouraged with much that I saw, at least in law student ministries. The ministry had grown to 850 student members. Law Student Ministries Division was supporting 165 Christian Law Fellowships throughout the nation. However, I left CLS with deep concerns about the ability of Christian law students and young attorneys to withstand the materialism and arrogance pervading the culture. My years at Law Student Ministries confirmed an assessment made earlier while teaching at Wheaton, namely that most Christian pre-law students lack the theological and jurisprudential moorings to withstand the moral relativism, indeed nihilism, characterizing most of American legal education. This grave concern gave rise to the founding of the Center for Law and Culture in 2001. Very briefly, the center's mission is to recover, and that's where these handouts come into play. And if I could just have a couple of volunteers, I'm not going to discuss this at length because my time is basically up. So I could just have a couple of volunteers pass these out. This contains information on the center. I'll just say a couple of brief words. The center's mission is to recover the traditional Judeo-Christian understanding that law is based on a moral order grounded in God's authority as creator. Now, in its earlier beginnings, the center was inspired by some fairly formidable scholars, J.I. Packer, Jay Budashevsky, Michael McConnell, Philip Johnson, Nigel Cameron, John Kilner, and others were involved in forming the intellectual foundations for the Center for Law and Culture. Through its Law, Justice, and Culture Institute, it seeks to prepare students for public service in law, government, and politics by providing worldview training, there's that word again, in the Judeo-Christian tradition. But I do think it is important that students have a place to come to study the higher law tradition, for example, transcendent moral truth as a foundation for the juridical legal order, to be encouraged in that before they have to tread that hazardous ground known as law school. Over the last couple of years, we have built strategic alliances with a number of organizations, Council for Christian Colleges and Universities, InterVarsity, National Association of Evangelicals, American Studies Program. 10 schools in the CCCU have endorsed the Institute. And it's essentially what it is we take gifted students interested in serving in law, government, and politics from a number of partnering schools. 10 of them are listed in the informational, in the mission statement there, and in the Center at a Glance sheet. And it's an intensive 2 weeks learning experience with guest lectures, field trips, critiques of movies, trip to the University of Chicago Law School, law library, sitting in on law school classes. This is where these students will get their first exposure, many of them, to the great legal theorists of the Anglo-American higher law tradition. Now, I would ask you to do one thing. If you're not going to use this, then just put it back up here, because I am married to an environmentalist, We want to save paper, and I believe in that too. If all you're going to do is throw it out, and that's okay, you won't offend me, because we can't know everything about everything. So just set it back up here. And then secondly, those who are interested, maybe you're not in that field, but maybe you know a student who might benefit from this program. Have them give me a call or write me an email. The center does facilitate attendance at this by awarding fairly generous scholarships. Now it's time to wrap up. I've gone way over my time, and I do have a rule in my classes at Trinity that if I ever exceed my time, I have to bring in donuts or cookies or some treat. And the reason for that is when I was at Wheaton as a theology student, I studied under Merrill Tenney, who back then was about 75, looked about 98. And he never ever ended class on time. If you had a class after Merrill Tenney, you were always late if you wanted to show him respect, which we all did. The theology students, all the rest would leave. In the other disciplines, they left. So we'd have about three of us sitting there, and Dr. Tenney would go over typically 10 or 15 minutes. So we'd show up to our next class 10 or 15 minutes late, and professor would look at us and say, "Dr. Tenney, right?" "Yep, that's right." "Oh, no problem, that's okay." So I promise that when I teach, I will never do that. Now I actually have a keeper of the time. They raise their hand at 5 minutes left, give me a signal, need to wind down. I didn't do that here because I already told you it was time challenge. So we'll wrap up here, and what I want to say is just come full circle to Witherspoon. We are facing daunting challenges in the United States, but Witherspoon's legacy counsels Christians not to lose heart, for the sovereign Lord reigns over the kingdoms of this world. His legacy also admonishes us to remember that all Christians are called to citizenship, to be devoted to the public order under the immediate order of providence. And this calling is a noble pursuit. Indeed, it is a manifestation of our love for God and for our neighbor. A constitutional order committed to the rule of law under God, Witherspoon stressed, is fragile. It's fragile indeed. This endeavor will require laboring in thoughtful and compassionate ways to protect our precious political and legal heritage. Thank you. That's all I have. I would say a couple of things. One is, the problem, as the Reverend Martin Luther King Jr. pointed out, is not with the principles enumerated in the Declaration of Independence, for example. The problem is with the implementation. It may have taken us longer to implement the principle of equality, for example, than we would have liked. Definitely it took us longer with respect to certain parts of the society. But in terms of Martin Luther King Jr.'s viewpoint, he affirmed not just the biblical tradition, but invoked the Declaration of Independence and its commitment to equality as a basis for securing equality for African Americans in society. And in fact, that's largely where Clarence Thomas was coming from too. His dispute was not with the principles of the documents. He would have disputed the fact that certain founders did not abide by the principles, that institutions were not consistent in implementing the principles. But over a period of time, I think it's a testimony to our constitutional order that we have principles that we aspire to and we take them seriously. If we didn't take them seriously, one would question whether or not we would have come as far as we have with respect to equality among the races, equality between men and women, and so forth. So that would be one response. The other response, this is a very long rabbit trail, strict constructionism, originalism. There's several forms. Suffice it to say that There is a form of originalism which focuses not on the particular peculiar practices and perspectives of this or that founder or group of founders, but on the political and moral philosophy of the founders as a group, which informed the fundamental documents of our republic.
I'd like to actually press the question of transcendent morality in the founding period. As I understand it, the debate concerning transcendent morality was already full rage in Witherspoon's time, in Scotland, in America, at the College of New Jersey, in Witherspoon's lecture, and I might even suggest in Witherspoon's own brain. But the debate was not concerning transcendence versus non-transcendence. It was the source of that transcendent morality, whether in fact it must come from revelation, or if it is, in the words of the Declaration of Independence, self-evident. Now, that terminology was comfortable for Jefferson because it was not biblical terminology, but terminology that was very coherent with the philosophy of moral sentiments coming out of Glasgow, which was a very vigorous project to ground transcendent morality without God. Now, do you see the coexistence of those kinds of points of view in the Founding Fathers as problematic long before Oliver Wendell Holmes?
Well, the Founders realized there was a problem initially when they tried to come together and pen the basis and grounds on a specific nature for the Declaration. They among themselves realized the broad spectrum. It was a fairly broad spectrum for that day. There, as far as we know, there were no atheists, although Washington called Paine a filthy little atheist. He didn't mean it literally, just didn't like his views and on the French Revolution in particular. So there was much more in common among the founders than there were differences. And there's no question there were differences. They did differ about the accessibility that human beings have to the higher law and the natural law. What do we use to discover it? Do we use reason? Do we use common sense experience approach? Do we use special revelation? Some of them did not believe in revelation, in scripture as an authority the way we do. So there were what I would call these in-house debates, and in that sense, the Declaration, no question, is a consensus document.
Do you find that consequential? I mean, perhaps in sort of a planting of a seed kind of way, consequential that you have this a coexistence of views? And do you see, I mean, I guess my question is, do you think it matters where our transcendent morality comes from?
I believe it definitely matters. It matters not just with the question of whether you believe it comes from God, but as Witherspoon and others talked about, it depends on what kind of God it comes from. That the founders were clear about. That the God of Christianity, or broadly speaking, the Bible, that tradition, was not the same God of other religions. So they did care about that. I would say from the standpoint, what I'm not saying is that I'm not an advocate of theonomy, I'm an advocate of religious freedom. I'm not an advocate of institutionalizing coercive perspectives about political moral theory. I am making the point that there was a moral foundation grounded in Christian truth that provided the foundation for our Constitution. And that is true. There were.
It could be seen as somewhat problematic for the argument we're trying to put forth.
Problematic only in the sense that I would say, in light of what we're fighting against in the legal academy, there is what we have in common, and what the founders had in common among themselves in terms of basic moral propositions. They had much more in common than, for example, comparing that to where we are today in the legal academy, where you really have a functional nihilism, a functional atheism. The assumption is We don't know if there's a God. It's not relevant anyway. If there's a God, we'll assume there isn't. We're going to teach law as a separate science, totally severed from any kind of moral inquiry. And I would submit that that is, you know, if you look at it from one perspective, among the founders, that was more of an in-house debate compared to what we're combating today in the Legal Academy. I'm not saying there aren't problems, and I don't want to gloss over that, and it's an important point.
But isn't our situation today a product of the religious freedom that you would defend and stand for, i.e. we're in a society where people are free to espouse views of the law that are, you know, not within a moral framework that we espouse? And that's just where we're at. We're in a post-Christian society. And so, I mean, that's one thing. And then the second thing is, so what does that bring us to as far as goals and strategy? What's the goal for Christians? I mean, a large segment of evangelicalism, just to kind of speak in generalities, the Christian right seems to have a goal in terms of its public actions of, let's take back the nation. You know, it once was a Christian nation, let's get back to that. And that seems to be the goal. And that's very problematic often because we then end up actually fighting on terms that aren't necessarily Christian terms. You know, it's just sort of we get bogged down in the political arena and just in sort of vicious fighting, even infighting because of it. So what would you see as, what are the goals? What are the strategies? What's to be pursued?
Well, those are two questions that would deserve extended answers. On the question of religious freedom, you can have a society that in its juridical order has committed itself through law to certain moral preferences, probably not a good choice of word, or moral truths, and yet tolerate and indeed even encourage more expansively the free exercise of all religions within the society, so long as the particular perspective or viewpoint or doctrine or belief does not threaten seriously something that is the established moral order of the society. So I believe those two can cohere, and I think that was the legacy of William Penn in the colony of Pennsylvania, the attempt to exemplify that, to have a constitutional order in a colony founded on biblical truth, yet one which fostered religious freedom. And that's an experiment we've carried out in a number of colonies, and to a great extent, I think, admirably. In terms of strategies, I am not saying that we should turn back the clock. Dallas Willard is right. You can't turn back the clock in the sense of what we need to do is just wholesale adopt all of the outlooks from several hundred years ago. In one sense, it's a broader and a narrower strategy. On the narrower side, what we have to do is first help our students realize, on the one hand, that what they're going to be exposed to in law school and many political theory classes is not the whole story. You will not read Bracton, you will not read Blackstone, you will not read Pufendorf, you will not read any of these theorists I've read. In fact, I didn't read any of them in either of the two schools I attended. And if we're going to have an informed debate, then it seems to me fair to say that actually the aberration here historically is not Clarence Thomas's assertion, but Lawrence Tribe's. They're the ones that should be, from a historical analysis, on the defensive. That's all I'm asking initially, is just we're going to raise this truth, we believe to be truth. We're going to expose students to this body of knowledge. I don't think a law professor should get up there and turn his lectern into a pulpit. I do think it's fair for a law professor to assign readings from Commentaries on the Laws of England by Sir William Blackstone. I'm not saying that the students in the class need to agree with that. I'm just saying, as a matter of fact, that was the single most important legal source for knowledge in the colonies and among the founders. So what does that mean? Some may argue it means nothing. That's all right. We'll talk about that. You know, on the broader issue, in one sense, I'm a Kuyperian. So, on a broader sense, socially, does that mean that we who are Christians, who have a robust or healthy view of involvement in public life, will we need to form a third party? I don't know. I don't have answers on kind of the grand strategy scale. Right now, all we can hope for in the legal academy is tactical. Because the legal academy is decimated, in my view.
One more question.
Well, we stated earlier that we believe that now in the new covenant, it is not the states that are supposed to be moral, the states are supposed to be secular, especially in light of Jesus' words, to give the Caesar what is Caesar's, and Paul's words, to obey whatever authorities are placed above.
Well, first of all, I wouldn't agree with the exegesis of that passage that you just gave. Using that as a basis, I don't think you can argue from that basis and extrapolate from that particular passage that is a source for the emergence and establishment of secular states. I mean, in fact, the debates between John Cotton and Roger Williams are the most fertile grounds concerning the extent to which government needs to, for example, coerce religious belief in the interests of protecting Christian orthodoxy, which Williams argued against. And I don't think that a Christian view is to describe the state as secular, because secular is, in fact, a religious position. It's a position against that which is religious. It's not neutral, so it's not an appropriate adjective. And it's not an adjective of our history in terms of how the founders or Lincoln, you know, Hadley Arks at Princeton, who founds his higher law theory in American history based on Lincoln. That's not how we have developed our own constitutional order. So I don't think that's an accurate description. I guess my fundamental problem is with the descriptive part.